We're all aware, and I'm sure in a lifetime we've had the experience of weighing something. This can be for various things. The most common example I can think of is in the kitchen, and that's because I spent, of course, many years weighing things in the kitchens before I went into Bible college. Strange to say that I end up going that way of life to be a chef. Well, that's what I was called, but it wasn't a very good one, by the way. When at school, every time I attempted to do something, it ended in a great disaster. There was one occasion we were trying to make these most exquisite and delicate ginger snaps, or brandy snaps, as they're often called. And my weighing skills were obviously failing at the time. And what was created was just a mess. It was a piece of rock, really, and not something that was eloquent or artistic in any way. So that was a blow to my future aspirations, but, well, I hope I learnt by that particular mistake. So we've all had an experience, we weigh something. These days, we don't really tend to use balancing scales. It's usually one scale, a bowl, and either it has a reading, digital or otherwise, and we put the ingredients in, we put whatever the need is in, and we weigh the thing together. But what Paul is dealing with here in verse 18 presents the image of balancing scales. For in verse 18, he says that I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Now, what Paul is doing there is something which we've all done in other stages of our life. We've come to some situation, and in our mind, we've weighed circumstances. So we have a decision to make, and we can't, of course, transfer it into a tangible form or a visible form before us. But what we do in our minds, we take one side of the problem and we weigh it against another side of the problem. Is the outcome going to be worth the effort that we put in? And that's part of how the Lord has made us. It's part of how we think. It's part of what makes us humans, this way of weighing things up in our mind. Paul weighs up the greatest of matters. Now remember, he has been dealing in verse 17 with glory. And he's been speaking to us, we can say, and speaking to those to whom he writes about those who are the children of God. They are heirs of God. They are joint heirs with Jesus Christ. Yes, they suffer, he says, but that we may also be glorified together. Now keep that thought in your mind, because glorified together is now where he takes his line of thinking. So what he does, he has this balancing scale in his mind, these weights that he's implementing. And what he's doing is weighing one thing against the other. This is something which Paul has done on other occasions, by the way. You have a verse in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17, and he says that our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So he says, you realize that glory is of a most weightier form, a denser form, than the light afflictions, he calls it. I don't think for a moment he's dismissing affliction. What he's saying is that it's light in comparison to what glory shall be. Now, it's my own personal conviction that when you come to verse 18, that Paul is not trying chiefly here to relieve the suffering of God's people. No, he is doing that. That's something which is achieved. You might think that's the dominant thought, that he's trying to comfort people in their sufferings and their affliction. Well, that's something which comes out in the letter and within this particular chapter. But it's not the dominant thought that Paul has here in verse 18. What he's doing is this. He's saying, look, do you want to try to determine what glory will be? Do you want to understand what it means to be glorified with Jesus Christ? Then the only way to try and even begin to understand what glory is to put it in one side of the scales and then to take what you can find and weigh it against it and see if it can be outweighed. So of course what Paul does, he places then glory in one side and he's thinking to himself, well, what should I take to try to outweigh glory? He doesn't choose possessions. He doesn't choose anything that's of a material nature or of a nature of blessing in the physical sense of the word. He doesn't deal with those things. He knows they don't stand a chance in many ways. But he takes one thing that grips the lives of many people, all of God's people, and it's their sufferings. And let me say, he's not taking just the suffering that people suffer as a result of being a Christian and his persecution. No, notice the wording he says, the sufferings of this present time. So whether we're thinking of emotional suffering, mental anguish, physical pain, he's saying, take it all. Take all the suffering, take all the pain, take all the agony, and put that on the other side. Take all those things that drag you down so many times, and see if that can outweigh glory that shall be revealed in us. And of course, it doesn't stand a chance. There is no comparison. It is a most powerful declaration. That's really all I want to say in relation to verse 18. It demands a lot more attention than that. The reason why is because this theme of glory that shall be spills its way into the following verse, which is verse 19. So he says there that the earnest expectation of the creature, now notice this, waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. So what Paul is saying is it's not just that Christians, as we shall see, who are waiting for the glory of God, but something else is waiting for the glory. There is something else that is anticipating glory that will be revealed in the lives of God's people, the sons and the daughters of God. And that then opens up a very fascinating subject altogether, because it gives to us the theme of our message this evening, creation and its groaning, or the groaning of creation. Now, what I want us to do is look at three things this evening. First of all, creation groans as it waits for forthcoming glory. Creation groans as it waits for this forthcoming glory. Read with me the words of verse 19 again. For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. It might be a bit of a mouthful, you know, when you read it like that, because of the usage of the words that Paul brings to us here. But it's the most powerful word which we have this evening. I think what's important is that we identify who he means or what he means by the creature. If you have a margin in the Bible, I'm not sure if you do, in the Bible that you have, mine has it here, that it can be rendered as a created thing. Now, a more accurate or a more simpler translation is actually creation than creature, because creature gives the idea of a person as such. But the word in the Greek, as it's often translated, comes to us throughout the New Testament as creation. And we'll see exactly why it refers to creation in a moment. So when you come to verse 22, you have this sort of declared simply before us, for we know that the whole creation. So those three times that you read creature, verse 19, verse 20, verse 21, it's the same thing as whole creation in verse 22. They're one and the same. Paul's not speaking about four different things in these verses. It's exactly the same in every case. The creature is the whole creation. Now that begs a question. How much of creation is Paul including here? Is he speaking about everything that we can possibly imagine? That means, does he speak about the angels? Does he speak about all spiritual angelic beings, or the demons themselves and the devil himself? Are we dealing with humans here? Or are we just speaking about creation in the sense of nature? Well, we can work this out in a simple way, just by a process of elimination. Now, it can't refer to angels. And when you say angels, well, it can't refer to the devil, because, of course, he's a fallen angel. It is not a reference to any angelic or spiritual being. And the reason why is this, is that when you think of the angels in particular, they were not made subject by God to a state of vanity against, in a sense, their own will. Why do I say that? Well, you look at verse 20 and you'll see what I mean. The creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him, that is of God, who have subjected the same in hope. Verse 21, the creature shall be delivered. Now, angels will not be delivered. Those who are fallen angels are reserved in chains of darkness forever. And that only leaves the angels that didn't fall. So you can eliminate angels and you can eliminate all spiritual angelic beings on that simple basis. It can't refer to those who are not saved. Those that you might say who are the non-elect. Because those will not be delivered from the bondage of corruption, as you read in verse 21. It can't even refer to the saved or to children of God, because they're treated separately in verses 19, 21, and verse 23. For example, if you read verse 19 again, the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. That wouldn't make sense. The sons of God don't wait for the manifestation of the sons of God. It's a clash of thoughts there. So that just leaves us with one answer. And this is where most Bible commentators do agree. And it's a reference to nature. It's a reference to creation all around us. And Paul is saying something quite remarkable here. He's saying that creation is in a state of earnest expectation. It's waiting. It's waiting. So let's think about this interest for a short time. You'll notice in verse 19 how he describes this waiting as an earnest expectation. I'm led to believe that the picture there of those words is of someone who is outstretching themselves. And they're so interested. They're watching, they're looking, just as if you're maybe looking out the window, you're waiting for someone to come along, maybe a delivery or someone that you're going to meet, and you're anticipating the event, and you're waiting for the event. It may convey the idea maybe of some particular event or something has happened. Maybe when there's been a terrible accident and people are driving by and they're turning their faces to the side and they're wanting to see what has happened. And that's what Paul is saying here, that creation in the natural sense, it has an earnest expectation. It waits with great interest. And what is it waiting for? It's almost too good to be true in a sense. If you didn't read it here, you wouldn't believe it in a sense. They're waiting, or creation waits for the manifestation of the sons of God. Now, it's very difficult to explain that because we're dealing with, in many ways, inanimate things. So when we think of creation, we're dealing with the trees, aren't we? We're dealing with the fields, we're dealing even with the animals. Those things that have no rational aspect or part to them. How could they possibly wait? How can a tree wait? How can nature, in a sense, wait for our glory, for the glory of the sons and the daughters of God? This is where we understand different aspects of Bible interpretation. Because what you have here is a type of personification. We read from Psalm 98, verse 8, let the floods clap their hands. When have waters ever clapped their hands together? Let the hills be joyful together. When has a hill ever skipped for joy? You don't see it. It's personification. It's attributing these aspects that we identify with as a way of teaching a particular truth. Isaiah 55, verse 12, for ye shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace. Now, in a way of describing that, Isaiah goes on to say, the mountains and the hills shall break forth before you into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. It's maybe a shame that the hills don't break forth in singing, especially sometimes when we need it here in the church. It would be good if we could have such things, but we don't have it. But Isaiah is saying this, that you'll be led forth of joy, and he illustrates it by how there is a joining from all creation in celebration of such things. So it's very simple, really. The attributes of personality are implied to convey the meaning here, to help us in our understanding. Now, something of that waiting is then also expressed in Romans 8 and the following verses, verses 20 and onwards, by the groaning and the travailing, as we shall see in a moment. But think about this. Why the interest. Why is it that God says that creation waits for the manifestation of the glory of God's people? What do they have to gain? What does nature have to gain by all this? Well, this is where we should never forget the link between man and creation. The curse of God fell upon both, and so the glory of the sons of God means the restoration, the renewal, and the regeneration of the creation itself. So we see here this very important point initially, as we have looked at. Creation groans as it waits for glory. Now, we've sort of established that first part. Keep it in mind as we come to our second point this evening. Secondly, creation groans because it's weighed down under the curse. Now, this is what people do. When someone sighs or they groan, well, it's often an indication that they're under a particular burden. They're either carrying a physical weight, and so they sweat with the weight. And there are the signs that there is a burden which is being borne, if it's of an inward nature. Maybe it's some trouble that we're going through, and you can tell the person. They're different from when you saw them last week. They're sighing with the burden which they have to bear. Well, you know, creation, it does the very same thing. It groans because of the weight which it is under. But it also, it groans in a sense of anticipation, as we shall see. But first of all, let's think about this weight which it is under. It's under a curse that it did not merit. It did not, in a sense, deserve, we should say. You know, that's one of the most obvious differences between man and creation. Adam, because of his sin, merited the curse, but creation didn't merit the curse. Creation was placed under the curse by God as a way of compounding the curse of man. It was a means of adding to man's curse because of sin. That's what verse 21 reads, and I hope it gives you a bit of understanding and clarifies a few of the verses there. Verse 20 is the reading that we're going to have here. The creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly. So when you understand what creature means, the creation or nature, creation, it was subject by God to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of God, by the purpose of God. Who hath subjected the same as creation in hope? In Genesis 3, verse 17, what did God say to Adam? God said to Adam, cursed is the ground for thy sake. And that's what he said. Adam, I've cursed the ground because of you. It doesn't deserve the curse because it can't deserve the curse. It's not a rational thing. It can't be held accountable in that sense. But in order to compound your misery, I've cursed it for your sake. And that's when you read the following verses. God says that it would yield thorns and thistles and all the things that in relation to the curse are found. And then you notice this in Genesis 3:19. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Now, among many things, I believe that the Lord is emphasizing the very link between man and creation there. Not to confuse the two, but there is a link which is borne out in Scripture. That is why creation will be restored. That is why creation will be regenerated. Not because, in a sense, it partakes of redemption, because it can't. Creation can't be redeemed because it hasn't sinned. But because it is joined with man. And just like we should say that the ground was cursed as a further loss to Adam, so the ground blessed will be a further blessing to the sons of God. We were thinking about this a few weeks ago in Dr. Brian Green's church in that new creation, heaven and earth. Well, this is a very similar type of thinking that we have before us this evening. And so creation is groaning under the weight. It sighs because it's subject to the curse of God. But you know, the groaning also gives us an insight. Notice what Paul says about the creation It's made subject to vanity. Now, that's a difficult word to understand at this stage. Because if you're like me, if you think of the word vanity, what do you immediately think about? You're thinking of inflated pride. You're thinking of someone that maybe, you know, spends all their time in front of the mirror. I don't think anyone does that, of course, here in the church, I trust not. I certainly don't, because I can't see myself in the mirror. It's always too low for me. But people who are very proud, well, they'll stand. And all they think about is themselves. And it's vanity. It's inflated pride and ego. Well, that can't be true of creation. So what does vanity mean here? Something of the Old Testament meaning is, before us, emptiness. Or some have indicated that it means futility. There's a certain futility, or there is a certain ineffectiveness about the creation that we live in. You might think, well, how is that possibly the case? Because every year we're sustained by what God gives us on earth. And we thank God for the harvest. It comes year after year, which is true, but it's not a perfect creation by any means. And it certainly doesn't reach its full potential. You see, remember, it is all intertwined with the curse, and it groans because it's subject to decay. One man says, though it aspires, it is not fully able to achieve. And how true that is. Because even though the flower blossoms, it fades. And even though the crop will yield its fruit, it will fall away. And even though there's the shooting forth, there is the inevitable casting and the cutting down. Isaiah said in Isaiah 40, verses 6 and 7, the voice said, cry. And Isaiah said, what do I cry? And God says, all flesh is grass. Now, why would the Lord compare flesh to grass? And why would the Lord compare life to the flower of the field? Because the grass withereth, God says, the flower fadeth, because the Spirit of the Lord bloweth upon it. Surely the people is grass. And so when Paul is writing here, he's telling us that the creation groans and it waits a coming day because itself is subject to a certain vanity. Hasn't reached its full potential. One day will do in that new creation. And what a wonderful day that will be. That brings us to our final thought. Creation groans as a witness to a coming change. Creation is a powerful witness. Of course, whenever to create the cause or to commit the heresy and the sin of worshipping creation, as many do, of course, and that's a sad trait of our times in many ways. But creation is a powerful witness. One of the great arguments that we have to bring people face to face with God himself. Paul says that in Romans 1:20, doesn't he? For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. And that's something to remember. The invisible things of God are clearly seen. Being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So creation, even though it's subject to the curse, and creation, even though it has an emptiness about it, it hasn't its full potential concerning it, it remains an effective witness for God. It says, look and see what God has done. When I survey the skies and the stars and all the handiwork of God, we say, what hath God done? How great he is. It testifies to his providence and the way God works in this world amongst the people that live in it. It is a powerful witness. But have you ever thought about this, how creation also witnesses to something else? Creation witnesses to the future, not just to the past and the present. It testifies to something greater which is to come. Now, how does it do this? It groans, Paul says. And so you have then in verse 21 and verse 22, the creature itself shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God, for we know, he says, that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. It is John Calvin, a great reformer, who, when he was commentating upon this passage, he said something along these lines, that these pangs, he calls them, are not just death pangs, they're birth pangs. I thought that was a wonderful quote. Why do we say this? Well, groaning, what does it indicate? In this sense, it indicates both suffering because of pain, but also hope. Something great to come. If we think of the illustration which God gives us here in Romans chapter 8 of the woman in childbirth, well, it's one of the most obvious examples. You know, we don't have to think really too much about this. We understand what is being suggested to us here. For when a child is being born, there is the pain of childbirth. There is a suffering in that sense. But there's hope, isn't there? Because life is coming. And that is what Paul is saying here. This is the groaning of creation. It is suffering, but it has hope. It is awaiting, even though it is enduring at the same time. Now, we might think to ourselves, well, you know, what are these groans that we're thinking about here? Well, how does creation groan? Well, I believe it's quite clear in many ways. When we see the natural disasters, when we see the earthquakes, we see the volcanoes, we see the disaster which can ensue by way of natural means. Now, I would never say that's the a particular judgment on a particular person, nation. Some people do that. I don't think it's wise to be so particular in those ways. We don't know what a country does or doesn't deserve. Surely our nation deserves many things. It's just that we live in a favorable climate in that sense, according to God's grace and providence. But certainly does act in these ways. But the bigger picture is this, is that when we see these things happening, we're saying creation's groaning. It's suffering in a sense. It's waiting. It's under the strain of man's sin. It's under the burden of man's corruption. But it waits a coming day. It waits a coming deliverance. Pain which results in a glorious birth. And that's that new earth and that new heaven wherein dwells righteousness. Now we know for believers this will be the enjoyment of the glory of God, and this will be where there's no pain and no suffering, no war and no contention, and other things that give us grief and heartache and pain and suffering. But what will it be for creation? Well, maybe Isaiah 11 verse 6 sheds light upon the subject. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. Reminding us that creation, as we know it, is still in a position of rebellion, in a raw state of confliction against itself. But God shall change these things. And the groanings of creation will give way to the rejoicing in creation and the partaking of the very glory of the sons of God. What do we say to these things? Well, Peter says it well in 2 Peter 3, verse 14. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found of him in peace, without spot and blameless. Now think about this. If that is what Paul is teaching in relation to the first groaning in creation, how great are the groanings of the saints of God and what that will give way to, and how greater the groanings of the Spirit of God and what that gives way to. We'll see exactly the full force of those words as we come back to it, God willing, next week. May God be pleased to bless his word unto our hearts. Amen.